So, happy Mother's Day, especially to those of you who are mothers. And, you know, my deep bow of gratitude and appreciation to all mothers everywhere. It's quite a thing to be a mother, watching one, seeing one, and my experience of it. And this morning in the paper there was an advertisement for visiting Scandinavia. And there were all these photographs of Scandinavia. And in Denmark, there was this photograph of the statue of a nude woman, kind of beautifully done statue. It kind of depicts a mother, and she's kind of in a sitting, somewhat upright in a pose of recline, of sorts, she's nursing the statue. It's a marble statue. She's nursing one child, one little baby, on one breast, and then there's some, like, seven other little babies crawling around on her elsewhere. And I think it's, you know, it was advertised. I think it was coincidence. It's Mother's Day. This picture was in there, but, you know, honoring, you know, it's kind of a statue honoring motherhood. And I showed it to my wife, and she said, the artist didn't have a clue. You know, seven or eight little babies kind of crawling on top of the mother, you know. And she's completely relaxed and at ease. There is a tradition of honoring, indirectly honoring mothers in the Buddhist tradition, by recognizing that one of the ways is seeing that the Buddha is, you know, very highly honored in Buddhism, but the Buddha himself was born from wisdom, or the perfection of wisdom, and sometimes the perfection of wisdom is called the mother of all the Buddhas. And there's a beautiful liturgy where it goes something like homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. The perfection of wisdom brings light, unstained. The entire world cannot stain her. She herself is an organ of vision. It goes on and on. And so the mother of all the Buddhas. And wisdom is seen, like Sophia is seen as being female. It would have been nice if I had come prepared to give a wonderful talk about mothers and Mother's Day and perfection of wisdom and all these wonderful things, but I didn't. But it's in my heart to do so. But what I'd like to do today is, what is in my mind to talk about, is share something. I want to share what's on my mind a little bit. And that is one of the people, I want to talk a little bit about one of the people who's been very important for me, one of the Buddhist teachers, who has one of the more profound, people who had one of the more profound effects on my life. A Japanese teacher named Shunryo Suzuki, Suzuki Roshi, who I never met. But his coming to the West and teaching here, because he taught in Los Altos in the 60s, he was a local fellow, people in Los Altos tape recorded his talks and turned it into this very famous book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Did you know that book was given in Los Altos? In a garage in Los Altos. And that book kind of what got me into Buddhist practice. And then I went and practiced at the Zen Center of San Francisco, which he founded with his students, and who'd become teachers after he passed away. And his legacy and his influence, his take, his kind of spirit and understanding of Buddhism was kind of my mother's milk in Buddhism. You know, it shaped me a lot. In a few weeks, a couple of weekends from now, Zen Center is celebrating his 100th birthday. And I'm a little bit involved in organizing that or setting that up. And so he's been on my mind. So I want to tell you kind of a little bit about him and tell you some stories about him and little quotes from him. So he was a Zen master. And he tended to call himself, when he first came here, Reverend Suzuki. And at some point, Alan Watts, who was around, told Zen Center, that mostly the Caucasian or the Western kind of the Caucasian students of his, you can't call him Reverend. He's a Zen master. You have to call him Roshi. Roshi kind of means Zen master. And he said, no, you know, call me Reverend. And then he went to Japan, and Alan Watts wrote a letter to Zen Center, to the board. He said, you know, in order to show proper respect, you have to call him Roshi. And when Suzuki Roshi came back from Japan, he was met at the airport, people calling him Roshi. And he said, what's going on? He said, well, the board says we can call you Roshi. And he laughed. And that was it. So from then on, we call him Suzuki Roshi. And this points to something that I think is fairly profound, that is a teaching that you find in some Zen circles. And that is that it's the student that makes the teacher. And here they were making him the Zen master. They were seeing him a certain way. They were calling him the Zen master. You're the Zen master. And then people started treating him like a Zen master more because of that title, perhaps. And you find that over and over again that that to a great extent it's the teacher. It's a student that makes a teacher. Now, there are certainly ways in which a teacher makes him or herself as a teacher. But I think it's safer when it's a student that makes a teacher. That somehow the needs, the questions, the concerns of the student, they come to this person and they have questions and they have particular needs of they need to have addressed in their practice. And the teacher then teaches what's useful for that particular person, offers his practice to that particular person. And if no one comes to study with the teacher is not a teacher, right? The teacher is only a teacher in relationship to other people. I think it would be kind of weird for someone to walk around with no one else around and hold themselves tall and straight and look at, I'm a teacher, isn't that great? No one's around, you know. When no one's around, the person's not a teacher. The person's just, you know, some guy or gal, some person who's just kind of, like I just feel like most of the time I'm just this, you know, kind of this odd guy who's kind of going around my business. And then occasionally I show up here and then all you look at me. And I said, oh, I better say something. And this is the way in which a student makes a teacher is very clear to me in how I was kind of created as a teacher or made as a teacher, grew up as a teacher. Because when I started teaching this group in 1990, I was really, you know, hadn't really been a teacher much or hardly at all up until that point. And still very much felt myself as being a student and not a teacher in a sense. And I could never imagine in 1990 that myself doing what I do now as a teacher, leading retreats and talks like this and all kinds of things, and being involved in people's lives in the way that I'm involved now at times, I would have been too intimidated or just, it was too daunting or too big of a shoes to fit into in 1990. And so what happened was that, you know, I started teaching for a little group of 12 people, you know, started giving little talks. And at first, I kind of very much assumed that I was there on invitation. And I didn't do anything unless the little group told me, asked me to do something. And then slowly the group grew and grew and grew. And at some point it became kind of a fiction that I was there on invitation. It's kind of still true, but it kind of like, people weren't, you know, it didn't make sense to kind of carry that. And then as the group grew, then I responded as being a teacher for a little bit larger group or for the needs of the particular people who came and all the variety of people who came. And so I was being shaped by the particular group that was there. And so I was learning how to be a teacher for that group. If I'd been trained or grew up to be a teacher in a radically different culture, then I would have been kind of been trained in some way by the group, by the society, to be a little bit different as a teacher, to respond in different ways, to talk differently, to see myself in a different way. Occasionally, we have people coming, occasionally, pretty regularly, but we have people coming from, people to our center who are from Indian descent, Indian culture, from India. And occasionally, when those people come, they're shocked at how the Caucasians in this group treat me. And because in India you treat the guru in a particular way, the teacher with much more respect than I get treated. But I'm actually quite content and quite happy with. I don't want to be treated with a lot of, you know, respect. I didn't even want to be on this podium, as some of you know. You know, I was kind of forced to sit up here, and I used to sit on the floor. So anyway, so what I'm saying is, in some ways, I was shaped and created. It was very interesting to watch that happening for me, to watch kind of the give and take. As I grew as a teacher, the group grew. And as the group grew, I grew as a teacher. It was kind of a give and take, a mutual thing that was happening. And so I couldn't take, you know, complete credit for it. You know, it was a mutual thing that was happening. Who I became as a teacher was becoming co-created by the group and by the people around me. And to a great extent, that kind of phenomenon is happening with people all the time. We're constantly being co-created by our culture, by our family, by our situation. And it's very rare that a person gets to see very clearly how they're getting created. And they perhaps sometimes in work you can see that. You see, you start maybe at the bottom of whatever the rung is at some company you go to. And so over the years you grow in that company and you get advanced and you can see how you're changed and by it all. But it's happening all the time. And sometimes in ways which are favorable for you and sometimes ways which are unfavorable. Some of the articles in the paper these days about how, given a certain kind of conditions, most normal people might be kind of pushed or led into becoming kind of abusers or torturers, as the famous 1971 study at Stanford showed with regular healthy students. So we get shaped and, you know, we get co-created. Part of Buddhist practice is to try to take some responsibility for that creation of who we are. And part of it is to recognize that co-creation itself. Now, Suzuki Roshi recognized this aspect of co-creation. And Zen tradition does. It's student that makes the teacher. Is a little saying that goes on. And what that means also is the teacher is different for every student. Each student makes the teacher a different person. And so every student will have a different view of who the teacher is. And that's also very clear for me in the kind of position of teacher that I'm in, that a wide variety of concerns come to me from different people. So like if I'm doing interviews and people are coming in through the door, there's a whole different universe that comes in. One person comes and talks to me about certain things, that person leaves, and a whole different universe comes in. And it's so radically different, the kind of concerns they have and their background, what's going on. And then a third person comes in, it's again a whole different universe. And so then I respond to that universe, I respond to those needs and concerns. And so we're kind of co-creating each other in a sense. And so who I am is, you know, unique to that particular exchange. You know, that relationship is unique for every person who listens to a teacher or hears a teacher, interacts with a teacher. Suzuki Roshi said once, everything is always changing, therefore I don't exist. And it's kind of basic Buddhist teaching that things are constantly changing and therefore there's no essential self, there's no eternal permanent self. And but because I don't exist doesn't mean, Suzuki Roshi didn't take that to mean, you know, some nihilism, like he doesn't exist in some absolute way. Well, in some absolute way he doesn't exist, but what's interesting about the Zen tradition, which the Theravada tradition doesn't do, in focusing on the teaching of self and not self, is the Zen tradition will say that yes, there's no inherent self, but if you want to discover who you are, you have to discover yourself anew in every situation. Who you are is discovered in responding and acting in every situation. When we engage in situation, that's where we discover who we are. If we hold on to who we have been, then we lose ourselves. But if we can let go of who we've been a minute ago and then step into the next situation fresh, uninhibited, unselfconsciously, then we discover who we are in that activity. It's kind of like when I was when I write sometimes, it really helped me in my writing when I realized that I didn't have to know the end of the sentence when I began it. You know, if I felt I had everything planned out ahead of time, I would agonize. But if I let some intuition, some spontaneity happen where I started to write, then something happens and I discover the end of the sentence as I'm writing, but I couldn't have planned it. We discover ourselves to some degree in the spontaneity, the intuition, or in the acting in the present moment. If we're always controlled, always trying to monitor ourselves and always show ourselves a particular way to the world around us, we kind of lose ourselves, would be the teachings of Suzuki Roshi. But it's in that acting. So this was, Suzuki Roshi said this, and I'll read the quote that kind of expresses this kind of nicely. He said, "The secret is just to say yes when someone asks you to do something. Jump up from your seat. Then there is no problem. It means you will be yourself without sticking to an old self. When you say yes, you forget all about yourself and are refreshed into some new self. And before the new self becomes an old self, you should say another yes." So, you know, sometimes you say yes by saying no. But I think it's a wonderful teaching. You know, you kind of engage, you kind of enter the world. And one of the people who knew Suzuki Roshi said he had an amazing ability to just enter into all kinds of different situations. There are stories of him kind of, he was a small man, less than 5 foot tall. He wore robes, he had a shaved head, he was Japanese. And there are stories like, for example, he would see these, you know, little group of construction workers in downtown San Francisco, you know, hanging out, talking about the latest 49er game or something. And he would just walk right into that little group and start engaging with them, talking about the game. And it would take them a while to realize this little Japanese guy in robes was talking to them. Because he would just kind of fit in. He kind of engage and enter into it so fully to what was going on. There's a wonderful little film clippage of him stopping at a gas station and getting out of the car and stretching. And then you see in the background shirtless hippies. And who seem so different from him. And he stretches and he goes right over to them and says, hello. And, you know, he's engaged people and met people where they're at and who they were. And this way of saying yes. And in that yes, in that engagement, in that encounter, being willing to encounter, discover the new self, who we are. And then he said, we should always be equal. If you know better than I, you should teach me. If I know something you don't, I should teach you. In this way, we should practice our way. Sometimes the student is the teacher. Sometimes the teacher is the teacher, and sometimes the student is the teacher. And for Suzuki Roshi, it was very important for the teacher to be willing to be a student, and to learn from the student when the student had something to teach. So it goes back and forth both ways, the relationship. He wasn't holding on to himself as a teacher. That's an old self. He was willing to be a teacher, but he wasn't, you know, stuck in being a teacher. He was whatever the situation required of him. He said, it is very silly to do something because people may admire you. It is your practice, not their practice. So you should be very independent. So don't practice in order to have other people admire you. It's your practice. You should be very independent. So here's this person who says, in some sense, I don't exist. In some sense, I get discovered in the relationship that I'm in. And at the same time, he's saying, be very independent. To say yes and discover who you are, to enter that situation, requires a certain kind of independent strength, doesn't it? Certainly confidence in himself. Here's a nice quote that I like. Ordinary people adore something holy instead of something common. This is the difference between Buddhism and most religions. So in Buddhism, we adore what's common. Isn't that nice? The ordinary things of your life. Have you adored your car keys lately? You know, you use them a lot. They're important. You stick them in your ignition, you know, slot there. You know, do you adore them in the same way you adore a Buddha statue? I think Suzuki Roshi, that's what he's saying here. Everything, all the common things, somehow are special or sacred or to be. I remember once being at a Zen Sesshin, a Zen retreat, silent retreat for 7 days. And I was sitting next to, or kind of across from, a visiting Japanese Zen monk. And he was kind of impeccable through the whole Sesshin. I was kind of admired him, the way he sat and practiced there. And part of the Sesshin, we were each given a cup for tea, a little round cup, that we kept at our place for 7 days. For the afternoon, they came and served us tea in the meditation hall. And at the last day, they served tea, and after serving tea, they would take the cup away, because they didn't need it anymore, take it back to the kitchen. And everything's choreographed in the meditation hall, so if someone does something which is not part of the choreography, then it kind of stands out. Well, as they came to get the teacup, the empty cup, this Japanese monk across from me went and he bowed to the cup that he had used for the week. And then he, you know, passed it on to the server. I go, wow, bowing to the cup, being grateful for the cup. Suzuki Roshi said, we should be very grateful before we have something. Isn't that, I love it. You know, usually we're grateful, you know, because we've gotten something. You know, thank you for whatever you did for me and all that. But he's suggesting we should be grateful before we have something. just an attitude of gratitude that we just carry with us. We're already grateful. Here's a little biography, a little description of Suzuki Roshi's childhood. An important influence for Suzuki Roshi was that he grew up in poverty. His father was a Zen priest, and he grew up in his father's very poor temple. His father would pick old vegetables off the road or out of the creek. Suzuki Roshi said that his father would make meals out of these vegetables even if they were decomposing. His father would say, "Everything has Buddha nature." When Suzuki Roshi lived in San Francisco, he sometimes picked vegetables off the street outside the local grocery store. If he bought vegetables, he would sometimes buy the old vegetables because he was sorry for them. I believe there were three crucial decisions that Suzuki Roshi made in his childhood. This is David Chadwick talking. He himself explained that he did this because of the historical persecution of Buddhism in Japan that he heard about from his father when his father was young. He experienced this himself in school. The other kids made fun of him because he was a priest's son. He was ridiculed at school for his poor clothes. During recess, he would stay in the classroom instead of playing with the other kids. His childhood years were very unhappy. And many people think of Japan as being a Buddhist country, but in the end of the 1800s and or so, there was a tremendous persecution against Buddhism. Monks were forced to disrobe in some provinces, and some people thought Buddhism was not going to survive in Japan. His sister said that he regarded his classmates as the enemy. When he was about 10 or 11, he decided to become a monk, partly because of an us versus them mentality. The second major decision was to leave the small town where he lived. One of his teachers in elementary school told him, "There are no great people here. If you want to be a great person, you will have to leave this part of Japan." Also, Suzuki Roshi did not feel he could learn Zen from his father. His father's temple was not a training center. The third decision was to study Zen with his father's disciple, Gyokujun Soen Roshi. Impressed and enamored with this big monk, he decided when he was 11 or 12 to go live at his temple. His parents said he was too young, but he protested that he had made up his mind and that his father had himself decided to become a monk when he was young. So his parents talked it over and agreed to let him go. Can you imagine that, 11 or 12 years old? Suzuki Roshi was committed to Gyokujun, his teacher, and remained his devoted disciple even though he suffered a great deal of abuse under him, including constant ridicule. Suzuki Roshi said that the abuse continued unrelentingly until Gyokujun died. Toward the end of Roshi's own life, he said, "When I offer incense for my father, I feel sad. But when I offer incense for my master, the tears stream down my cheeks." The love Suzuki Roshi felt for his teacher was mixed with some very painful feelings as well. And here's a quote from Suzuki Roshi. "Great Zen masters are monks who had a difficult time in their early life." One could not talk about Suzuki Roshi's life in Japan without saying that his second wife, the mother of his children, was murdered by a monk whom Kichizawa Roshi, his Zen teacher at the time, had insisted he keep at his temple. The monk had been severely traumatized by the war and was clearly mentally ill. All three children and their mother, everybody had urged Suzuki Roshi to get rid of the monk. But Suzuki Roshi would hear none of it, perhaps out of duty to Kichizawa Roshi. Her death was a turning point in Suzuki Roshi's life. People said that he got softer after that and started listening better. Here's what Suzuki Roshi's son said about the same thing. A monk who was staying at our temple killed my mother. At that time, I was away playing with my brother. Suzuki Roshi, my father, was also away at that time. After this tragic accident, my father said, "Don't be resentful of the monk who killed her. Just be resentful of me." I think that what he meant was that he was feeling responsible and very apologetic. Here's another thing Suzuki Roshi said. "Unless you can endure the bitterness of defeat, you cannot really be strong." So here's something more about the student-teacher relationship. If If you want to study Buddhism, you should enter the room. Entering the room is a kind of an expression in Zen that means you enter the room of the teacher, like for an interview and for one-on-one teaching from the teacher. So you enter the room. You should not stay at the edge of the teaching. You shouldn't just be a weekend Buddhist. You are quite free, but you should enter our teaching. Don't try to understand it intellectually or by means of experience only. Experience, of course, is important, but a more important thing is the confidence to believe in yourself. And you should be faithful to what you feel and to what you think. You should not fool yourself. It is quite all right to say to the teacher, "I cannot agree with you," or "I cannot accept the teaching." That is how we make our understanding deeper and deeper. Isn't that great? I love it. So you know, you don't have to agree with the teacher. One of my teachers, Zen teachers, who was a student of Suzuki Roshi, we were having a talk one day, and I told him that I had trouble accepting some of his teaching. And he turned to me and he said, "Great, that's where we're going to meet. We'll meet in that difference. That's where we're going to see each other and really kind of have a chance to connect. If we just all agree, maybe, you know, who knows what will happen, but we really meet in the differences." If your understanding is not deep enough, I will tell you it is not deep enough. I won't say it's wrong. There is no wrong in life. It's not wrong, but maybe it's one-sided or not deep enough. So we should make our understanding deeper and deeper and deeper. That is how we practice Buddhism. There's nothing new for us to study. Here's an interesting statement. There is nothing new for us to study. Isn't that great? So I'm going to say more, but you know, we come to Buddhism and we want to learn all this Buddhism and we learn a little bit, and so there's more to learn, you know, and more new things and dependent origination or whatever, and let's learn all this important stuff. And Suzuki Roshi says, there's nothing new to learn, to study. But Buddha's teaching will give light by which you can know yourself. The light by which we can see ourselves like a mirror is Buddha's teaching. You follow that? So we use Buddha's teaching, we use the teachings not to study them in the abstract, but we use them as a mirror, as a light, to help understand ourselves. And it doesn't have to be necessarily that you agree with the teaching. Sometimes the teaching you disagree with will help you the most in understanding what's going on in you, what your understanding is, or who you are. Which is a stronger person, he said. Which is the stronger person? Is it easier to beat someone up? Or is it easier to be patient while being beaten? Blanche Hartman said, Suzuki Roshi was very encouraging when I felt discouraged and like a bad student. But one day, I had the feeling, hey, I've got it. I think I'm finally doing Zen meditation. Wow! So I went to tell him about it. He was very different that day. He said, don't ever imagine that you can sit Zazen. That is a big mistake. Zazen sits Zazen. Just to follow your breathing doesn't make sense. If you are very kind with your breathing, then one after another, you will have a refreshing feeling in your Zazen. And when you have a warm feeling in your practice, that is a good example of the great mercy of Buddha. After a wedding at Tassajara, there was a celebration with a band. Lou Richmond was playing keyboard, David Chadwick was playing guitar and singing, and someone else was on the drums. Suzuki Roshi was sitting on the corner of the platform playing a kazoo. If you become too serious, you will lose your way. Our practice starts from the actual problems we have. For the religious mind, there is no fear of death. The fear of death exists in the realm of thinking or emotions. When you attach to something, that is the beginning of being afraid of death. Okay, so one last thing I'll read. When I was a philosophy student, at UC Berkeley in 1959, my epistemology professor was teaching about the assumptions we make in believing the world to be real. At almost the same time, I heard of this remarkable Japanese man, a Zen master. When I went to hear him, one of the first things he said to me was, "If it isn't disappearing, it isn't real." So we have a couple of minutes. Do you have any comments or questions or that you'd like to share about this? Yes?
So does that book, the beginner's mind, the fourth to Buddhism, so can you get in touch with what was about that book that was
What was it about the book Zen My Beginner's Mind that worked for me? I can't point to anything in particular, but when I read it in 1974 or something like that, 75, I had this very strong feeling that I was reading what I already knew. So it was like coming home, this is what I already knew. This, it was like, oh yes, it just went along. It was like speaking what I knew, kind of, even though I didn't know that I knew it until I read it. And also the book talked a lot about Zazen, meditation. So that book then prompted me to kind of start my meditation practice. Yes?
It strikes me that in a way
Yeah, why he came to America. The people who have tried to answer that question, David Chadwick in particular, who wrote his biography, said that he was at the docks in Yokohama as a young man in his 20s, and he saw all this cheap, shoddy kind of goods that Japan was sending out to the rest of the world. It was before Japan started making really good things after World War II. They're making cheap things for export. And he was so embarrassed by what Japan was exporting to the world that he thought that Japan should export what it really knew was really precious. So for him, that was Buddhism. And that was part of it. I think part of it was that I think he was interested in... my sense is he was interested in leaving Japan and going into some very fresh, new place. He was very excited about being in San Francisco because he felt that the people here who discovered Zen practice had these very fresh eyes and fresh ability to incorporate Buddhism into their whole lives in a way that maybe he didn't see possible anymore in Japan, where it was the religion people grew up with, and here people have brought these fresh kind of approach. So that's about all I know. He tried various times to go to America. He asked his teacher if he could go when he was relatively young. He studied English early in his life. He had a license to teach English in Japan. His teacher refused to let him go. And then by the time the teacher died, he was so kind of enmeshed in being the abbot of his own temple, they didn't take care of that. And then in about 1959 or 58 or so, there was a notice that went out that they were looking for a priest for this temple in San Francisco. It was like a 1 or 2 or 3 year position. And so he applied for it. And then he came. And the idea was just to come for a few years, at least what was a stated purpose. But he was so impressed by the people who came to sit Zazen with him that he decided to stay for them. And then eventually there was some tension between the Japanese congregation and those Westerners who were not part of the congregation, because it was like one group of people were sitting Zazen, sitting meditation with him. And the Japanese congregation, it was more like their church, where they weren't really sitting much Zazen. And they kind of resented all these people from outside the congregation coming and sitting, and a lot of them were dirty hippies, came barefoot and long hair and dirty clothes, whatever, and it was pretty far out. And he was asked to choose. He had to choose between the congregations. And then he, eventually left the Japanese temple and started Zen Center.
You mentioned the concept earlier, to be glad for something before you have it.
To be grateful.
To be grateful.
Yeah.
That was very intriguing, but I'm not quite sure how one would go about that.
Maybe it's a developing an attitude of gratitude that doesn't have to have an object. Just a sense of gratitude. I often feel that when I meditate. At the end of my meditation, I feel a deep sense of gratitude and appreciation, but I can't tell you what I'm grateful for. Objectless gratitude. And if you have that attitude, then it's easier to fill it with the objects. You're ready. Oh yeah, this is great, thank you. Thank you.
Kind of like an intention.
Kind of like an intention, yeah.
Your intent is to be grateful, to be open, to receive what's coming about.
Yes, I think so. Thank you very much, and I hope this was interesting for you to hear about Suzuki Roshi, as I honor one person who's been an important teacher for me and my teachers. So, thank you.